This is the takeaway for Tuesday, February 6th, 2018. And stick around to the end of the podcast to see how you can participate in our new project, The Science of Happiness.
This is the takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick.
Americans are getting older and living longer, and that means every year more and more older Americans need care at home, in assisted living, in nursing homes. But as the population ages, one big question is, who will care for them? One in four caregivers in those nursing homes, home care agencies, and assisted living facilities is foreign-born. The number's grown in the last decade, and that's not including the large number of home aides who work under the table. Well, immigration is changing in this country. And as President Trump and his administration crack down on both legal and illegal immigration, there's not a lot of attention on how fewer immigrants could affect how Americans age. Stephen Campbell is a policy research associate with PHI, a nonprofit research and consulting group. Stephen, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you've done some research here on the role immigrants play in the home care and nursing care industry. Break it down. Just how important are immigrants in caring for America's elderly?
So immigrants have a very large role in caring for the nation's older adults and people with disabilities. That stat that you just cited, that one in four workers is an immigrant today, is a pretty big shift over the past decade or so. In 2005, only about one in five workers were an immigrant. So these trends seem to suggest that as the population of older adults continues to grow, we're relying more and more on immigrants to provide the daily assistance that older adults and people with disabilities need.
And certainly, as you look at the numerator, as I mentioned, the American population is aging year by year. We're getting older as a society, so that role becomes more and more important.
That's absolutely true. I mean, currently, according to the most recent estimates, about half of people who require long-term care are under the age of 65. But as time goes on and baby boomers continue to age into older adulthood, that population of older adults who require care is getting larger and larger.
So, Stephen, there's been a lot of news lately on temporary protected status, TPS, as the Trump administration moves to revoke it for several countries. You have some numbers on care workers from countries that have had TPS in this country, in particular Haiti. What can you tell us?
So we're not experts in immigration policy, but we do know that our data finds that there are about 35,000 workers from countries for which TPS is soon to expire. Most of these workers are from countries like Haiti and El Salvador. Many of these Haitian workers are primarily working in Florida and in the Northeast. So there are pockets of these immigrants all across the country for which the changes in TPS status could have a real impact.
Now, what about people who come from countries covered by the travel ban, Muslim majority countries? Are those countries contributing a significant amount of labor to the home care and nursing care industry?
That's right. There, according to our estimates, there are about 10,000 workers who come from travel ban countries. Most of them are Iranian or Somali. In fact, Minnesota is one of the places where these Somali workers are settling, and there are already reports that resettlements for these people coming from Somalia are starting to slow down, and that may have an impact on the supply of direct care workers in those areas.
So let's talk a little bit about right now, and then we'll sort of talk about the trajectory of this issue. 35,000 workers from these TPS countries, maybe 10,000 from travel ban countries. 45,000 workers sounds like a small number when you look at the size of the healthcare industry across the country. But is there any evidence that fewer workers right now could start to impact care on the wards, in the nursing homes, in home care?
We are hearing stories of from employers that they're already experiencing a slowdown in job applications. For instance, a provider who typically hired Haitian workers is already seeing that positions that used to be easy to fill are now the job applications are starting to dwindle. And that's going to have the smaller supply of direct care workers can have a real detrimental impact on the consumers who rely on them, the older adults and people with disabilities.
So, Stephen, look, we're used to hearing in the immigration debate in this country how industries like hotels and hospitality, agriculture, restaurants, they rely on immigrants for labor, and that those industries are very nervous about moves to crack down on even legal immigration, big, powerful industries in some cases. But do policymakers, in your view, and even ordinary Americans, have an appreciation for how much care of the elderly and disabled rely on immigrant workers?
Well, I think one big difference between those industries and the long-term care industry is oftentimes this work is being done behind closed doors. It's very intimate and very private. So until people have experiences in the long-term care industry, they may not be aware of the issues that are waiting for them when they need care eventually. So that's one big difference. Certainly, I think that as the workforce is growing at a breakneck pace, I think that it's increasingly common for policymakers to start paying attention to this workforce. We've seen states all across the country enacting policies to support this workforce better. And to really stem the high turnover and high vacancies we see in this field.
Well, the population continues to age, Stephen. Under current trends, there's really no stopping it. The nursing homes will be more crowded. More people will need home care. Assisted living will become a more lucrative industry as the decades go by. If we're going to stem or reduce immigration in the long term, where does this all go?
So any efforts to stem the number of direct care workers, the supply of direct care workers, can pose some real issues in the future. As you said, the population of older adults continues to grow, and that's fueling just skyrocketing demand for this workforce. The next 10 years alone, we'll need 1.3 million new direct care workers. Among them, 1 million will be home care workers. So that's larger, collectively, that's larger than demand for any single occupation. So we really need to be thinking creatively about how we can better support this workforce and really rethink the way we think about this workforce.
And, you know, I have to tell you before we run, Stephen, in all of the immigration fights that I've covered in Congress and anywhere else, I've really never heard anyone mention the needs of this industry and the needs of Americans going forward. They talk about farms, they talk about restaurants, they don't talk about home care.
That's right. I mean, it's difficult to address these issues, but I think we can start by providing these workers with a living wage, a high-quality, culturally competent training, and in general, just greater respect for their very important role as a foundational element in our long-term care system.
Stephen Campbell, Policy Research Associate with PHI. Stephen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We've been hearing your stories of nursing home aides and other caregivers who came here from another country.
Leah Kurzer, Brooklyn, New York. Our family relied on Abraham, a gentleman from Sierra Leone. His invaluable caring and respect for my father gave our family peace of mind.
Hi, this is Tony from Upper Dublin, Pennsylvania. My husband has cancer and was just in the hospital with a number of medical problems. The home health aide is Haitian. She's absolutely wonderful. I'm not sure if anybody else would do that kind of work in this country.
Hi, my name is Mary Cook, and I am from Limerick, Pennsylvania. My aunt was suffering from terminal brain cancer. Most of her hospice care workers and caregivers were from Liberia.
This is Jermaine from Florida. As a nurse, I rely on these healthcare workers every day. They are smart, well-trained, and dedicated. This ill-conceived immigration policy by the Trump administration puts everyone at risk, not just healthcare workers. Imagine this flu epidemic with less people able to care for everyone. I shudder to think of it.
Your voices on the role that immigrants have played in caring for your loved ones. Well, in nursing homes and care facilities across the country, administrators are seeing the shift firsthand in their workforce. Mary DeGangi is an assistant vice president at the Menorah Center for Rehabilitation and Nursing Care in Brooklyn, New York. She says the change in temporary protected status, especially for her Haitian workforce, could impact the care that patients at her facility receive.
We are overseeing 420 patients on any given day who require a variety of healthcare services from rehabilitation to everyday care. It's really in that everyday care that we all kind of take for granted the things that we can do on our own that our residents cannot take care of, that daily living essential activities that we all have been able to do on our own. So our CNAs in particular are essential to getting that function for our residents to help them to do things better, to enjoy their life a little bit better. And as we start to see a decline in applications and individuals coming into the facility for jobs, we are concerned on how we are going to fill that gap.
Well, I want to talk about that gap. And these CNAs, these are certified nursing assistants, is that right?
That's correct.
And do you have any numbers? Do you know how many CNAs who you oversee are immigrants to this country?
Here in Menora, in total, we have 600 employees. 400 of them are direct caregivers, and about 250 of them are CNAs. About 10% of the CNAs are currently affected by the current ruling regarding TPS. What I mean by that is that we have approximately 25 individuals who come from Haiti, who are here on temporary protective status, who are in threat of having to leave our country and these jobs.
So we talked a moment ago about that temporary protected status, that TPS that you mentioned, Mary, immigrants from El Salvador, Haiti, Nicaragua, even Sudan, set to lose their status, they may have to leave. Can you talk a little bit more on what you've seen as the direct impact on your workforce in your facility, both for TPS and for other immigration policies that are changing now?
Sure. You know, it's a wide range. I find that first looking at the employees themselves, how are they affected? The thought process that the employees are going through seems to be somewhat evenly split. Some of them are in fear of, pretty constantly in fear of, some sort of threat of deportation, whether it be at the end of TPS or, as you say, you know, maybe they're connected with individuals who are on different statuses, while others are very optimistic. Some of them are very confident. It's all going to work out. I mean, after all, they came to America where dreams come true. These same employees are coming in each and every day to take care of our residents with that same optimistic view. But at the end of the day, you know that there's that little bit of, you see that little bit of shadow of doubt. And that doubt can be a scary thing if you bring that into the healthcare arena.
Have you noticed an effect on elderly patients or other patients that you care for? Is this starting to affect the way people do their jobs?
Well, we're aware of it. We're aware that employees do the best job and there is a connection between patient care and employee satisfaction. And employee satisfaction, there's an element of that as feeling comfortable in your workplace, to be able to come to work without fear. We as a company have done a lot around that. Now, this outside force, something that we can't necessarily control, is a concern. What we see is that most recently, when we weren't sure whether we were going to be able to continue to employ our Haitian population earlier this year, we started to look for our remaining workforce to take on additional shifts, to be prepared to take on additional shifts. And even just the thought of taking on these extra shifts began to affect the satisfaction of our employees. They were imagining how tired they were going to be, how stretched they were going to be. And while we've been lucky enough to have the resources we have so that it has stopped short of actually affecting any of our residents, we certainly see the potential. And it doesn't stop from happening just because we think about it. It's a lot of work and a lot of effort to ensure that our patients remain unaffected by this.
You know, you really get a sense from talking to you, Mary, how interconnected all of these things are. The American population is aging. More and more of us will be in nursing homes in the future. There's really no way around it. We're fighting over immigration, and these two things are intimately connected. I'm not sure that most people have a real sense of that.
I would agree. I think that the situation in general is often very misunderstood. People either don't think about it, it doesn't necessarily, they don't realize it's going to affect them. But, you know, the TPS and people that we have working for us and that we know in other organizations, they're making a significant contribution. they do actually have work authorization. They're allowed to be working here. They are contributing members of our society. If we begin to lose these valuable contributors, it's not just today, looking at our numbers and our stats today, we are anticipating a rise in the need for these individuals because people are living longer. We have more people to take care of than we ever have before, and that trend is going to continue. And if on the side of the healthcare worker that number begins to go down, we're creating an ongoing gap that should be a concern to every one of us.
Mary DeGangi with the Menorah Center for Rehabilitation and Nursing Care in Brooklyn, New York. Mary, thanks so much.
Thank you.
A 139 days since Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico. And here are some facts that you're probably aware of by now. Nearly 500,000 people are still without power. Access to clean water remains a big problem. Tens of thousands have chosen to leave the island, including 25,000 students, and hundreds of schools shut down entirely after the storm. Many have never reopened. Rebuilding will be a long haul, and on Monday, Governor Ricardo Rossello proposed a massive overhaul to Puerto Rico's public education system, setting up a system of charter schools and vouchers, strengthening vocational schools. He also vowed to give teachers in Puerto Rico a pay increase. We have the governor on the line with us now from Puerto Rico. Governor Ricardo Rossello, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you, Todd. Thank you for the opportunity.
Governor, we have a lot to talk about in terms of your island and recovery from the hurricane, but you had a big announcement yesterday about education and the state of public schools in Puerto Rico. What's the status of the schools today in Puerto Rico? How many are up and running, and how many students are you expecting to lose as more and more people head to the mainland?
Well, it's a good question, and that's part of the reason we're fast-tracking our education reform. You know, we already had it as part of our government program, but certainly because of the hurricane, the loss of students, we really need to get a handle on metrics and good accountability on our system. So to answer your first question, we have most of our schools open already. We were pretty quick to do so. Just as a comparison, by the time that New Orleans had one school open, we had over 1,000 of our schools open already. So we have most of the schools open. Those that couldn't open because of significant infrastructure damage, we assigned students elsewhere so that the school year could progress. The announcements are essentially based on three pillars. Number one, it's an overhaul of the administrative structure. In education has been notoriously known in Puerto Rico for being sort of an administrative heavy bag with not a lot of flow through to the students. So we are consolidating many of the intermediate bureaucratic steps. We are creating the figure of the superintendent and some local educational agencies. And we're, for the first time, believe it or not, assigning a budget that is on a per student cash or money assignment. So we're going to get some visibility, clarity. We're going to make sure that everybody has a full faculty in Puerto Rico and that the ratio between students and faculty is appropriate. The other two components are we're adding charter schools to Puerto Rico so that we can, you know, attack a lot of those schools that haven't done so well and give those children the opportunity to progress. Of course, those schools will be property of the state, but will be administered by non-for-profits, municipalities, academia, or otherwise. And lastly, once we settle down some of these numbers and some of the problems of students leaving Puerto Rico and so forth in the next school year, by the 2019-2020 school year, we're going to have a voucher system so that folks can determine where they take their kids to school.
Well, Governor, I know that you know that a brand new charter plan island-wide and certainly a voucher system are going to be controversial. You might be prepared for that fight. But a lot of schools were closed after the hurricane. Some never reopened. Why is the time now, in your view, for what appears to be a pretty major educational change in Puerto Rico?
Because precisely a lot of the students have left right now, and there really was no handle on a school budget, accountability for it, a per student or per pupil assignment of money. So we really have to change those metrics and push them forward. That allows us now to have a handle on the system and actually invest in the teachers. For example, yesterday we also announced that we were going to give the first raises to teachers in over 10 years in Puerto Rico. And that's precisely because we can rationalize the expenditures in our system. So I think it is urgent, and I think that as part of the process of recovery, it is important that we have a significant focus on getting better schools and getting more options to the parents and to the kids.
And let's talk about the teachers, too, since you mentioned them, Governor. You've got a $1,500 raise for teachers as part of your plan. We have a group of teachers and students from Puerto Rico. They sent us some questions about the educational reforms, knowing that we'd be speaking with you today. And I wanted to play a question to you from Jesus on this very issue that you mentioned.
Governor Rosello, my name is Jesus La Santa. I live in Puerto Rico. How would this educational reform will improve the living condition of teachers?
Well, we're establishing a clear career ladder, which we really didn't have for teachers in the past. So that means that the teachers will be incentivized to either keep on studying, working, get raises for their evaluation, and have a path to progress. This really wasn't clear in the past couple of years. So in my view, there are more opportunities for teachers. Of course, there is the other side of the equation, which is accountability. There's going to be accountability. We're going to be making sure that teachers, principals, have accountability and show results because failure is just not an option here in Puerto Rico.
And Governor, we got another question from Juan Giusti Cordero, a professor of history, who wants to ask about the education department.
Hello, Governor Rosello. In an interview on Sunday, Puerto Rico's Secretary of Education, Dr. Julia Kelleher, said that when she arrived at the department, all her staff had been named and were political appointees of the party in power, that is, your party. How do you plan on eliminating the profound politicization of the education department, and how will the charter school structure, which will involve many outside contractors, avoid reproducing or indeed intensifying that politicization?
Let me address that concern. First of all, I agree. Historically, the education department has been very politicized. That is why I went outside the box and selected a secretary that had no party affiliation, because she wasn't even from Puerto Rico. That's Dr. Julia Kelleher. She has been phenomenal, and she has been creating her team, of course. Once she arrived, you have to understand that the education department is a big monster. It has over 60,000 employees. She didn't have a lot of the people that you should have for certain appointments. So suggestions came all across the board, but she certainly has had the flexibility, and she has done so to select the folks as time comes along. On a merit basis, it has been decades of that politicization that the professor spoke about. And my commitment, and I think I've shown it with actions, is to eliminate that, to put children first, to put options first. And I think that's what this system is going to do. With regards to the charters, charters are going to be evaluated, you know, as any other schools. And if they don't produce results, the good news is that you can change those folks that don't produce results. Our objective and the secretary's objective is to find world-class stakeholders to run these charters, right? So that they have the expertise, the experience, and that they can ensure that the children in Puerto Rico get the best possible education.
Well, Governor, let's step back from your education reform proposals for just a moment and look at the overall recovery in Puerto Rico. The official death toll from Maria was 64 people, but investigations from the New York Times, other news outlets, concluded that the actual death toll may be more than 1,000, 1,050 or more as a result of the storm. You said last month there would be a major investigation looking into the official death toll, what the actual numbers might be, and why the number 64 might be misleadingly low. Where does that investigation stand now?
Well, it's carrying through as we speak. We've established arrangements and collaborations with academia and with our government structure. There's two paths over here. Number one is verifying what the actual certificates say, right? In the onset, the reason why we had such a low number, or you know, perceived a low number, is because we could only tell or establish what were certified deaths, that the doctors established that it was either directly or indirectly related to the storm. So the first step was to go through all of the death certificates once again, call back the doctors, and make sure that if in some cases they established that it was a natural causes, but really it was something due to the storm directly or indirectly, we can account for those. And secondly, there is a more scientific approach to evaluating the deaths. So they are working to give the most accurate sort of predictive number in terms of the deaths. And once the study concludes, we'll certainly make it public.
And Governor, looking forward, before I let you go, tens of thousands of people have left Puerto Rico for the mainland after Hurricane Maria. It's unclear how many will ever return. The island is saddled with debt. You've said it'll be years before that debt can even be addressed because of all of the other priorities now of rebuilding Puerto Rico. What's the future of the island as you see it now? I know you're optimistic, and I know that's part of your job, and I know you love Puerto Rico. Realistically, the next 5 years, 7 years, what do they look like for Puerto Rico? What do you need?
Well, the next year is going to be tough. There's no doubt about it. I mean, we've just went through the largest natural disaster in the modern history of the United States, not only of Puerto Rico. But really, I think we have an opportunity to rebuild. I think this is critical. And to answer your question, what do we need? We need Congress to act. There is a supplemental, not only for Puerto Rico, but for other states, that has been established, but that hasn't been seen by the Senate yet. We're asking for Puerto Rico to get fair and equitable treatment here. We're asking for, you know, the Medicaid fix, as was done with Louisiana, so that we can get the cost sharing, you know, waived for 2 years. We are asking for tax considerations based on the sort of tax overhaul that really hindered Puerto Rico as a jurisdiction. We're asking for 100% cost sharing from the FEMA programs as well, and some directed funding for certain areas in housing and the energy grid, because Puerto Rico, different to the other jurisdictions, we have a fiscal crunch. So we really need some seed funding to get things started. I know it's been a catastrophe. It's been a challenge. I've been in the center of it. But certainly, as governor, I need to look at the opportunity. And there is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for us over here to change, you know, the energy grid from 1950s old energy grid to one that can be a model across the world, leapfrogging into utilities 2.0, changing an education system that doesn't give the service it needs to give to the children for them to be competitive in the real world, to one that actually does and that gives every child the opportunity to move forward, to put some competitive tax components here at the local level, because we sort of got railroaded at the federal level, so that folks can see Puerto Rico as a destination to prosper and to create jobs and alternatives. So again, I understand that this is a long road ahead, but it's one that I am willing to embark on, that the people of Puerto Rico are willing to embark on, and that if we execute and get the proper resources, it's going to be a great Puerto Rico 5-7 years down the road.
Governor Ricardo Rosselló of Puerto Rico, thank you for your time, sir. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom.
This is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with WGBH Radio in Boston.
Thanks for joining us this hour. I'm Todd Zwillick. In Savannah, Georgia, the Eugene Talmadge Memorial Bridge stretches 1,100 feet across the Savannah River, connecting the city with Hutchison Island. It was built in 1991 and named for Eugene Talmadge, the three-term governor of Georgia who served from 1933 to 1937 and again from 1941 to 43.
The trouble with most of our officials, if they're good men, they're inclined to be a little timid. And if they see opposition staring them in the face, that's a great temptation to trim or back up.
Now, Eugene Talmadge was popular at the time, but progress has changed the way many Georgians view Talmadge and his legacy today. Talmadge ran his 1946 campaign on a platform of white supremacy. He promoted Southern segregation and advocated for racist policies in Georgia's state university system. So now, like so many other landmarks and monuments across this country, the Talmadge Bridge is getting another look in Georgia. Last September, the Savannah City Council passed a resolution to rename that bridge. Here's former Savannah Mayor Otis Johnson back in 2017 at the time of the council vote.
Not if, but when that bridge is renamed, it will make national news because it will make a very positive statement about Savannah and the state of Georgia in terms of moving into the 21st century and letting some of the scars of the past heal.
Well, the former mayor is right because the name is making national news, and now it's up to the state government in Georgia to confirm that resolution from Savannah. And that's why hundreds of Girl Scouts are descending on the state capitol in Atlanta today. Why the Girl Scouts? Well, they have an idea about what that bridge should be called if it is renamed for the 21st century. Sydney Roberts is a Girl Scout from the Girl Scouts of Historic Georgia. She's 15. She's also from Savannah, and she's with me now. Sydney, what do you propose for the new name for the bridge in Savannah?
So we want it to be named for Julia Gordon Lowe, who's the founder of Girl Scouts. She founded it in 1912 in Savannah. And the reason why we think that she would be a great person to name the bridge after is that she was just really influential and helping a lot of girls develop courage, confidence, and character.
Tell me a little bit more about Juliet Gordon Lowe, her role in Savannah, the kind of life she led, and what she was about.
Well, she lived in Savannah her entire life. She spent some time in England, but for most of her life she was in Savannah. And in 1912, when she started Girl Scouts, she was 52 years old. And she just wanted to help as many girls as possible become the best people that they could be.
What was her life like in Savannah when she lived there?
So she was married to a person named Willie Lowe, and they didn't have any kids, and he died at a fairly young age. And so when she started Girl Scouts, she was actually a widow. And so she started Girl Scouts. She wanted girls to be able to do anything, and that included basketball. And so she told the girls to come to first headquarters wearing their camp uniforms. And those camp uniforms looked really similar to what their underwear looked like at the time. And so they walked downtown Savannah in the middle of the day wearing basically their underwear, which was a little shocking for a lot of the citizens. A lot of people thought that girls shouldn't play sports, but Miss Juliet thought otherwise. And so a lot of people weren't happy about it, so she actually sewed a curtain around a courtyard so that the girls could play without getting criticized. And so Miss Juliet's thinking that girls should be able to play sports really influenced the public's opinion. I used to play volleyball. I don't currently play any sports now, but I think that it was really empowering to know that Miss Juliet made that change.
Let's talk a little bit more about the history of the Girl Scouts and even the history of the Girl Scouts in Georgia, where you're from. When the Girl Scouts was started, like so many other things in the South, it was all white, right? When did it integrate?
So Miss Juliet believed that anyone should be able to be a Girl Scout. So the first African-American troop in Savannah started in 1917. Just 5 years after Girl Scouts started, and there's been various troops around the country that are African-American from the beginning.
So I know the city council in Savannah has decided to change the name away from the Eugene Talmadge Bridge. Why do you think that it's a good time for a name change, and why this particular change from Talmadge to Lowe?
So with Girl Scouts, our focal point isn't on that the name should be changed. It's that since the council decided that they wanted the name to be changed, that Juliet Lowe would be a good candidate.
So, Sydney, it's pretty exciting. What's the whole experience been like?
It's been super cool. I've never done like any political thing like this before, so it's been really enlightening to learn like how the process works, and it's just gotten me even more comfortable with speaking in public.
Well, Sydney, I know that you follow the news now that you're involved in politics yourself. There's been this Me Too movement around the country. I know you've seen it, where women are pushing to have their voices heard. You're having your voice heard. I think Juliet had her voice heard, too. Why do you think it's important for a woman from history, a woman like Juliet Gordon Lowe, say, to be remembered publicly in this way?
Well, Miss Juliet was so influential in changing a lot of people's opinions on women and on girls. Before, a lot of people thought that they couldn't do a lot of things, but Miss Juliet helped to show people that girls could do anything that they set their minds to. And really, just if you try hard, then you can do whatever you want.
Well, you're 15, is that right?
Yes.
What issues are important to you as a young woman in America today?
I think that a lot of the same issues that Miss Juliet stood for, equality and, you know, just giving everybody a fair opportunity.
Well, Sydney, it's great to see you out doing some politics and great to see you out advocating for this name change and for something that you think is important. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Sydney Roberts is a Girl Scout from the Scouts of Historic Georgia in Atlanta, now from Savannah. Sydney, it's been great having you.
Thank you.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. In Florida, more than 1.5 million people can't vote. They're ex-felons, and though they've served their time, the state's constitution bans them from voting unless they get clemency from the state. And to get that, you go before a board headed by the governor. A federal judge in Florida ruled last week that that board does not have clear standards and that the process for deciding who gets back the right to vote and who doesn't is unconstitutional. It's a big fight in Florida. Charlie Crist was the Republican governor of Florida from 2007 to 2011. He's currently a congressman and a Democrat, and he told me that under his administration, ex-felons were given a second chance.
Under our administration, over 155,000 former felons got their rights restored during the 4 years that I had the honor of serving as governor of Florida. Under the new administration, however, they changed it right away after Governor Scott got elected in 2010. And only about 3,000 people in the past 7 years or so, almost eight now, have gotten their rights restored compared to the 155,000 we had. So it was a dramatic change. It broke my heart because I believe in second chances and I believe in forgiveness.
At what point when you were in charge in the governor's office did felons have their rights restored? Was it after prison time was over, after probation, and after restitution, after all of that was cleared?
That is correct, yeah. In other words, you had to, quote-unquote, pay your debt to society. You know, somebody had committed a crime in you know, the cases we're talking about here of a nonviolent nature. Once that sentence, probation, had been served, then they'd paid their debt to society. And so if you truly believe in that, as I did, their rights would be restored upon that completion.
Do we know under the current system that Governor Rick Scott has instituted, he chairs a commission of himself and members of the cabinet, they decide. Do we know who they're deciding gets their rights back and who doesn't?
I think a big part of the judge's ruling that came down last week basically says that it's too subjective, it's almost a mystery, and, you know, it's sort of at the behest of whatever the governor and the other members of the Florida cabinet think it is. And being that subjective, it makes it very difficult for someone to know what the parameters are, what the expectations might be, because from one applicant to another, they change. And so that's part of the problem, and I think why the judge made the ruling that he did, that in fact it's unconstitutional.
Let me take the real politic view of this, Congressman, if I can, and I'm positive you've been asked this question before. You might view your differences with Governor Scott from a partisan lens, saying, well, Charlie Crist wants more felons to vote because those former felons might be more likely to vote Democratic. Rick Scott doesn't because those former felons might be more likely to vote Democratic.
Well, I can give you my perspective. Mine is not a political one. Mine is a moral grounding. And I didn't really look at it as a right versus left political sort of issue, more of right versus wrong.
Congressman, Governor Scott's response here suggests a pretty rapid appeal. Based on what you know about the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, which would get this at the next level, where do you think this case heads?
Well, I'm not sure, but that's a very important point, I think, because, you know, some may be cheering, and I'm among them, the ruling, that is, and I think that that's important. But I also think that we have to remain vigilant because, you know, the appeal process will take time, but can drag out for quite a time in some cases. And that's why it's so significant that in Florida in particular, we now have this constitutional amendment that we know for a fact will be on the ballot in November of 18. Another addition to that that makes it additionally challenging is the fact that in Florida we require a 60% majority in order to adopt constitutional amendments to the Florida Constitution. And so it's going to take a lot of work. I believe and hope and pray that it will pass, but that may happen before the end of the court scenario.
Congressman Charlie Crist, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Todd. Appreciate your time.
One view on felons' voting rights in Florida from the former governor there. Well, not everyone agrees. Richard A. Harrison is a Florida attorney and executive director of Floridians for a Sensible Voting Rights Policy. They're a nonprofit that advocates for a case-by-case review for all felons in the state and opposes the federal judge's ruling in this case.
The board consists of Governor Scott and several of the cabinet officers. They are the ultimate decision-making authority on clemency petitions. The process is described a little bit in the judge's order. There is a waiting period on the front end. So before one can even apply for clemency, there's a waiting period of either 5 or 7 years. Then a petition is filed. There's a lot of data collected. And at some point in the process, the applicant is entitled to go in front of the clemency board and try to make their case for clemency. There are some rules that govern how the board operates. Depending on your point of view, either the act of clemency is completely discretionary with the governor and the board, or if you're Judge Walker, it's completely arbitrary.
Do we know typically who gets denied and who gets granted a restoration of voting rights in front of this board? There have been criticisms here that very few people got their right to vote back, that it went from 30,000 under Governor Crist to 3,000 under Governor Scott. Do we have any data about who gets a yes and who gets a no?
I don't know that there is any data that is the kind of information that you could look at and analyze to try to figure out, you know, what gets you forgiveness and what doesn't. We certainly know the raw numbers, and you've mentioned some of them, but I don't know that there's a whole lot of substantive data that's maintained.
Well, Richard, I think a lot of people looking at this from a distance might think, well, if you commit a felony, you get caught, you plead guilty or you're convicted, you might go to prison or have some other punishment. Once that punishment is done and you come out and all your restitution is paid, why don't you get your voting rights back right away? They say the debt to society is paid. Why should there be anyone deciding that you might not get it back?
Well, let's go back to the fundamental premise, which is this idea that you go to prison, you serve your time, and your debt to society is paid. And this has sort of become the lead argument, the appeal on the other side of this issue. But that's not really how life works. There are lots of situations where if you commit a crime, there are serious implications that will follow you long after you get out of prison. If you commit a sexual felony, you may serve all your time, get out of prison, and find that you're on a registry of sex offenders, which will haunt you for the rest of your life and dictate where you can live and where you can work. So this idea that there are no consequences of crime once you walk out of prison simply isn't the case.
Why should voting be one of those consequences, though?
Well, the short answer in Florida is because the Constitution says so.
So you're of the view that the federal court decision was wrong here. What would you like to see happen here?
Well, I don't want to talk too much about what might happen in the immediate short term because the parties have until next week to submit additional briefing about what an appropriate remedy might be. Eventually, what will happen is the judge will consider whatever the parties submit in this next round, and he will then issue some type of an injunction, and it will tell the state of Florida either that it must do certain things or it must not do certain things. And then I assume pretty confidently that the state will appeal that decision to the 11th Circuit.
Richard A. Harrison, Executive Director of Floridians for a Sensible Voting Rights Policy. Thanks so much for being with us.
Sure. Thank you, Todd.
And before we go today, I want to remind everyone that we're teaming up with the Science of Happiness podcast this month, and we want you to participate. This week's challenge is the Three Good Things exercise. So here's what you need to do. Spend 15 minutes today writing down three things that went well for you and try to articulate why these things made you happy. They could be small, like a coworker making you a cup of coffee, or big, like getting a raise. It's all part of the science of teaching your brain to focus on happiness. So try it out. Tell us about it. The Science of Happiness team will be back tomorrow. And give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Again, that number, 877-8-MY-TAKE. We want to hear your three things and how reflecting on those things made you feel. We might play your answers on the air tomorrow. And to find out more about the Science of Happiness, go to our Twitter. We'll have a link pinned at the top of our page. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.